Well, sometimes they have to kill us. They have to kill us. Because they can't break our spirit.
Look, I don't have to do this.
You don't have any choice.
I am trying to help you people. Now, why won't you accept that?
It's in our DNA. You have to do what old man says.
What makes you such a threat?
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power, Ray.
Prophecy Keepers Radio.
This is Joss Ogonie, Will Bluewater, a seventh great grandson of Samanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. OCO, Ginalii, this is Blue Otter coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the Cherokee Nation.
Beginning of Part 1. Please refer to program notes for the scheduled date and time of Part 2. Thank you for supporting Prophecy Keepers Radio with your tax-deductible offerings to the Oklava Native American Church of the White Roots of Peace.
Hello, everyone. This is Blue Otter, and this is Prophecy Keepers Radio. I'd like to welcome everyone to the show. I'd like to introduce our special guest today. Is Chokosh Aho'o. She is a Chumash Indian elder of Coastal California Indians. And how are you today, Chokosh?
Oh, very well. Thank you, Blue Otter. Nice to talk to you.
It's a real treat to have you. And I guess we had a chat the other night and talked about lots of interesting things. And I thought I'd tell the folks how I found you, and we'll just kind of go from there.
Oh, great. I'd like to know myself.
Well, as you know, I publish a couple of prophecy encyclopedias, one for the Eastern and one for the Western Hemisphere. And from time to time, I do a web search, anything having to do with the Hopi elders and And I guess about a year and a half ago, ran across your name on the internet, because the elders, I guess, had called you back, I guess, about 10 years ago, and had a couple of messages. The most impressive one to me was the 10 points that they gave you, and then the one that I guess Uncle John gave you, which. Yeah, the two of them together make a lot of sense. So, and I guess you knew what John Lanza and his wife. And why don't you go ahead and tell us about those experiences?
Oh, all right. I was not raised in the Indian tradition. My grandfather on my father's side was Chumash and some early California Spanish, and my grandmother German. And the Indian connection was not spoken of, although I was quite dark-skinned. And on my mother's side, her people came out of Mexico in 1922, and they were some Spanish and French and then Yaqui and Mayo Indians, all coastal people. And I had a feeling, and there were times when my grandmother on my mother's side would kind of make jokes, and at one point she put into my hands, when I was about 16, a blanket, which she said had all of the medicine and the journeys and what it was that her grandmother had learned, and she put it in my arms, and but she didn't go into any detail. And they were of, as many other Indian people of my age now know, there were some generations there that were either too afraid to teach their grandchildren or their children Indian ways, or they were ashamed.
Uh-huh.
And, but I had this predilection, this tendency to live in the trees, to take my shoes off, to talk to the earth. And in 1965, I happened to join some Baha'is at a fireside in Tempe, Arizona. And there was a man speaking about the Apache people and about Geronimo. And he had people come up and look at these photographs. And I was so deeply moved. There was a photograph, a large photograph, of Geronimo up close. And his eyes simply glistened and burned. And it was like the whole history of the Indian people and all that they had gone through and their courage and the beauty that it would survive no matter what, within his eyes. Well, it was, I probably have never had anything hit me so hard. And I went outside just to be out of the room. Suddenly there was so much, seemed like so much noise that I just needed to get quiet. So I went out and I stood under the desert night stars and just began weeping. It was like feeling the waves of what had happened to the Native peoples, what had been their experience. And it was, I just began crying. At first I thought it was for myself, and then it felt like it was for all the world and all the generations of all the people, because of the terrible ignorance that causes so much pain. When I came back into the building where Philip Cassidor was speaking, he looked at me very directly the moment that I entered, and for the next half of the Baha'i fireside, speaking about his people, he never took his eyes off of me, and I felt my whole life at that moment shift. Afterwards, he came up to me and he said, "I want to take you to my people. I want you to meet my mother." And I think there was a short visit. It's kind of who I met goes way back quite a ways. That would have been early 1966, I think. And I ended up, they made a dress for me, and I danced with the people there for 4 days and 4 nights and during the ceremony. And this was my first real experience with not in the movies Indian. And of course, there's no, it seems like almost no connection. Shortly after that, and there's a whole story of what happened the 4 days that I was there. Shortly after that, living near the beach, there was a community radio station there called KPFK in Los Angeles, part of the Pacifica radio. And a friend of mine had asked me if I had heard the 5 days of interviewing the Hopi elders, who was called a colloquium. And I said, no, I hadn't heard that. He said, well, you must make this connection. He had come all the way down to the beach to be sure that I knew this was happening. And he ended up taking me to a place in Hollywood where Thomas Banyankya and one of the Hopi elders, David Manantier, were speaking. And there was also a man there who was Chumash. He called himself Semu Huahute. And I sat there and I listened to the elders talk about how the government was attempting to regain, take away all the Hopi land by a terrible system of mortgages. It was a 27-page bill that was kind of being snuck and yet pushed through Congress, called the Omnibus Bill, or Omnibus Act. So I don't think I spoke to the elders that night, but I went home and tried to write letters, tried to compose a story that could be published exposing this. And I realized that I was making a terrible mistake, that by my trying to help without personal knowledge of the people I was crusading for, that I might do them more harm than good.
Mm.
And with that, I took my two young children who were sleeping in their beds, put them in the back seat of the car, a bunch of laundry that I figured that I could wash somewhere along the way, and started heading out for some place called Hopi. And then I arrived in Flagstaff a day or so later and suddenly became terrified that what did I think I was doing? Who did I think I was? And would they ignore me or laugh at me? And suddenly I was facing the mystique of the native wisdom and my own inadequacies, and ended up staying 3 days and three nights in that motel room with my children, just not knowing whether to go forward or go back.
Mm.
And finally, I just decided it was worth the risk. And so as I then drove onto the Hopi reservation, the Hopi land, I won't call it a reservation, I pulled into a place, and I think that I, by that point, had known that it was Haute Villa. And I got the two elders, Thomas Manyankya and David Manaki, I got their names mixed up. And I drove up to a bunch of Hopi kids playing baseball out in the field, and I asked them where Thomas Manangie or David Banyakya was, and they just looked at me and laughed and pointed in the direction of the adobe houses and said, it's the one with the blue door, and then they giggled and all ran away laughing. So I drove a little further in, and I got out of the car and looked around, and all the Hopi houses had blue doors. And so I just walked up to the one that was directly in front of me, and I really was terrified that I'd be seen as a fraud or an interloper or who knows what. And I knocked on the door, and an old man came to the door And it began to thunder and lightning, and the rain began to come down very hard. My children were asleep in the car, and this was a good thing, because then the elder looked up at the sky. He looked at me and invited me in. We sat in front of his pot-bellied stove on two overturned buckets. He offered me a cup of coffee, and the next hours were just lost in storytelling, wonderful, wonderful things. Time passed like magic. My children stayed asleep, and just about the time he and I came to the end of what we had to say to each other in that moment, then my children came in the door, and I was invited to come and live in Hopi, and David Menangier, one of the fathers of the Kachina, or grandfathers of the Kachina clan, he and his wife Nora gave my children and myself their bed, and I began to live at Hopi for the next year.
That's an amazing story. Did you meet Tazula Brinkerhoff when you were...
No, the name isn't familiar.
She was a teacher of mine. She was an adopted daughter of David and Nora.
Oh, is that right? They were wonderful people. Wonderful.
And wrote a book during that period of time. And
what year was that?
Well, I want to say she was probably researching it in the 60s. And
I was there through 66 into 67.
Well, I've got the book here in front of me. Yeah, it looks like it was 71, but I know she was around them earlier than that, because she, I remember the stories. Of course, she had met Rolling Thunder earlier, and so I think the relationship probably went back to the mid 60s, and you might just not have run into her, and because I know there's pictures of David and Nora at Zula's house up in Salt Lake. She had been secretary to the governor of Utah. And,
you know, there was a man named Larry, I don't remember his last name, who, we were both going back and forth. He came from someplace else, but, you know, for a while I didn't move out of my other house, and so I was going back and forth. And they thought in Oraibi, where David and Mina Luxa lived. Oh, that was your question, wasn't it? He was a special friend of theirs. So mostly in that beginning time, I was in Hood Villa, living at David and Nora's house. And then I spent time with Pamina and Thomas Benyakia at their home. But lots and lots of time sleeping in my station wagon parked in front of Mina and John Moxa's house in Oraibi. And it was in Oraibi that I think most of the knowledge was passed on to me. There were little incidents that happened in Hood Villa, but the lessons came from Oraibi.
Yeah, that would be the center of the culture, definitely. What a story. That's amazing.
I'm told it's the oldest continuously inhabited community in the Western Hemisphere.
That's right.
And they have great ties to the ancient Incas and Mayans and Toltecs.
Yeah, they have a parrot clan, so you know they had to come from someplace else.
Well, it was there that they told me about the Great Migration. And part of my love is to learn more and to share at whatever level of knowledge I have at the time. These migrations of people fascinate me. And when I lived among the Maori of Aotearoa, they told me about their great migrations, which they call the Hikoi, in their wakas and canoes and where they came from and how long ago it was. There's so much we can talk about.
Oh, it's amazing. The one of my pet subjects is, of course, the Cherokees. We were told by our leaders in 1750 that we came from across the Eastern Ocean, and archaeologists and ethnologists point out that the only place that you, in the world that you can find dolichocephalic skulls, which are long, thin skulls, other than around the seacoasts worldwide, is up in the Appalachian Mountain chain between Alabama and Pennsylvania, surrounded by other cultures. And of course our language is completely different, so I think and even the name Maori is so close to one of the ancient names of the Phoenicians, which is Mauru, in northern Africa today is Mauritania, Morocco, and I think it's very possible that that the Maori people, you know, may have some ancient connection with those.
Prophecy Keeper, Prophecy Keeper.
OCO. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
OCO is Cherokee for hello. This is Chia Sagonige, also known as Will Bluewater. I'm the International Communications Director for the Cherokee Nation of Mexico. I'm speaking on behalf of the seven clans and beloved woman Sharon Rogers, wife of Chief Priest and Principal Chief Charles L. Yatlohi Rogers, M.D., oncologist. Their family discovered the tomb in Mexico of Sequoia, the world-famous inventor of the Cherokee alphabet, and the namesake of the Cherokee National Forest in California. The state of Oklahoma was very nearly named the state of Sequoia. Nación Cherokee de México, the Cherokee Nation of Mexico, is known in the United States as the Cherokee Nation of Sequoia of Mexico, Texas, and the USA Reservation and Church. Free of any charge, we are accepting citizenship and adoption applications, not only from Cherokee descendants, but from all people of good heart, from all lineages, just as we did for the 10,000 plus years before the United States government fairly recently imposed restrictions on Cherokee citizenship. Tennessee Governor Sam Houston had not one drop of Cherokee blood, yet he left office and later became Kalanu, or Speaker of Council, second only to Chief John Jolly of the Cherokee Nation West. The Republic of Mexico has recognized the Cherokee four times since the 1700s, and Spain five times before that. We possess original physical copies of all those treaties. In January of 2001, the San Andres Accords, enabling government-to-government tripartite relationships between sovereign Indian nations and the government of Mexico, were passed by the Mexican Congress. A few weeks later, the first such sovereign Indian nation, Nación Cherokee de México, was federally recognized in a solemn ceremony in Torreón, the capital of the state of Coahuila, formerly known as the province of Coahuila in Texas. The ceremony was followed by a fabulous celebration, which was attended by Cherokee elders from all over the Americas, including citizens of the federally recognized Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, people like Squaw Yi, the famed bowmaker, Al Heron. There is so much more to share with you, so I encourage you to visit our website at CherokeeDiscovery.com. While you are visiting the website, feel free to fill out a free citizenship application. Please be patient, though. We have no paid staff, and applications may take up to 9 months or more to get processed. If you're not a Cherokee, feel free to request adoption. And please don't forget, tell them Bluewater sent you.
Well, let me share with you what Hakaba Matu, who was thought by many as king of the Maoris in a village called Pauranga. What he told me is he was able to recite his whole lineage that went back over 1,000 years.
Oh, see you.
And he said, on great ships, and that all, but there were times that there was land travel, and he talked about the people being up in Tibet and coming down in through India and going, you know, this different journey he showed me. And then he said that we came around the tip of South America, and our people, some of our people, stopped and created a community in what is known as Easter Island, and they call it Rapa Nui, and they still speak old Maori there, and that's where the Akuaku statues that are built on the cliffs overlooking the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And he said they have a whole thing that they recite about going into Tahiti and Hawaii. And then also, I do believe that the Haida people in the Queen Charlotte Islands may be part of that great migration. And then he said then they finally, their last stop, I believe, was, and, you know, and of course they're peeling off in different groups and then colonize those areas. And the last to be colonized was Aotearoa, the land of the long white cloud. And that was also told to me in a mystery school called Manu Ariki. And that's an ancient mystery school. Their genealogy is very, very important to them there.
That's astounding.
You know, before I start telling these people's tales, I did a meditation while I was preparing to talk to you. And trying to think at first, I couldn't imagine. There's so much to talk about, so much to share knowledge with. And I couldn't think of how to begin. There's different parts here. Like there's of course, my own personal story, which is still going through its stages. There is just little anecdote stories of people I have met who've been my teachers. There are political aspects to this, and then there are the lessons, what I called, in the beginning when I started teaching, I called them 11th hour tools for spiritual activists who are in a hurry, for spiritual warriors in a hurry. And then the Hopi called me back to them in April of 93 and said to me, Chukosh, you've been telling the people that this is 11th hour. Now you must go back and tell them that it is the hour and there are things to be considered. So there are the tools and then there are the sacred stories. And in my meditation, it was all a jumble, and then it came to me that perhaps before I start telling other tribe stories for them, that I should probably do a sage ceremony and then maybe start with some shorter sacred stories that, and then wherever that leads to. I think that that's a value to the people, and that folks that aren't going to be particularly interested in my personal story, but they do want to hear what are the sacred stories, we might as well get them before they lose interest. Okay?
Sounds real good.
Okay. I just feel more comfortable preparing myself in this way. And so I have before me an abalone white sage, and with the miracle that is fire, I take that element and I take it to this sage. And there comes from this sage smoke, sacred smoke. And many people have seen people just I take this sacred smoke and I purify my ears so that when another speaks their truth, I will be able to hear it. I take this sacred smoke and I purify my mouth, for it is from this place that the Great Spirit has given me to speak my truth. And I take this sacred smoke and with conscious intent, I purify my heart, for it is this place we all know the truth. I take this sacred smoke and with conscious intent, I purify my whole being that I may be here in a sacred manner with you all.
Oh.
Let's start with a petroglyph that I'm looking at here. It's a Shumash petroglyph, and it was sent to me, and I guess it's repeated in many, many areas where the Shumash were, and that was a large, large area. This particular one, I believe, was taken from the Carrizo Plains, and but it is also in the mountains of along the coastal mountains of Santa Barbara down to Topanga. And I call it one of the Shumash creation stories.
Uh-huh.
Let's see if I can describe this petroglyph for you. There are two shapes of figures. They're the same size. They are in a dusty kind of a brick red color. And they are joined together in their arms that are next to each other, and then their outer arms are reaching up to the heavens. There is like a great sunburst of yellow coming from their heads, and at one point it connects those beams of yellow light coming from their heads. They're connected there in the head and the arm. What I see this to be is that there was a time before matter when all was just energy. And there were two sovereign energies that did not come together. And one was the positive, one was the negative. One was the sacred feminine creative energy, and the other one was the sacred masculine creative energy. And until they came together, there was no form, only energy and space. When they came together, each remaining independent and yet joined in thought and in deed, they both became pregnant. And this shows a great blue surrounded by yellow circle in their bellies. Both the sacred feminine creative energy and the sacred masculine creative energy, in joining their thought and deed, both became pregnant. And then from their bodies came the great rains filled with the seeds of all life and form as we know it, and it rained down, creating the earth, and it soaked into the earth, and then from that earth, all life. It's a beautiful picture, beautiful picture. And you can't tell which is male and which is female. They are the same size. They are equal. They are in perfect balance. They are separate, and yet they have agreed to join together, and then both are pregnant. And I love that story.
That's a wonderful story.
The Maori have a similar story about Papa Tuanuku, who they say is Mother Earth, and Rangotani is with Father Sky. And before there was form, there were just these two great lovers, and they held each other so close, so tightly in their love and in this embrace. Well, there was another god named Maui, came along, much like our coyote figure, and he decided that these two beings needed some space. There was not room for anything else. And so he planted a tree in Papatuanuku's belly. And as this tree, the great Totara tree, grew and began to spread its branches and forced a space now between Rangotani and Papatuanuku. And so that from this longing for each other and the great love in that was now separated or their embrace, from that then all things grew and came to be.
Oh.
So sometimes in wedding ceremonies I talk about that you can love so much, but there needs to be some space that allows for balance and each one to create as they were made to do.
That's true.
So that's just a petroglyph. When I lived among the Hopi people, they would take me out, particularly John Longsa would take me out and explain to me the different sacred places on that particular mesa and what happened in their history and when the Mormons came and took their children and built a church there, and they were warned not to do that, that they were building on a sacred site, and they built anyway, and how it was destroyed by lightning. And as we would walk along the very uneven ground around Oribi, and no matter how careful I was, I found myself tripping and going up and down on this uneven ground. And then I got a funny feeling and noticed that this old man, John Longsa, Minor Longsa's husband, that he was just kind of coasting really smooth, and there wasn't even the motion in his shoulders of someone walking. And I looked down in some amazing way, expecting what I next saw. And what that was what I now call skimming. His feet were moving just above the surface of the earth, like maybe, I'm holding my fingers up, my joint finger, maybe 2 inches, 2.5 inches, right along the earth, and just as smooth as could be. That happened to me about 3 times.
My word.
Then, and that was around 1966, I guess, toward the end.
Yeah, Handsome Lake reported that same kind of phenomena with the three that appeared to him.
The Tibetans know it well as well.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, they just call it skimming. It reminds me a little bit, well, I don't know why do I call it skimming. I don't know, maybe like when you toss a flat stone out across the water, and when it moves just above the surface of the water, one of those really good skips.
Huh. I know.
It's quite something. I've never done it on purpose. It's just snuck up on me a couple of times.
Isn't that something?
Hi friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you have been listening to our program for long, then you know that Mark the Badger Borcherding does a Mayan birth reading for each of our interview guests. Mark suggested that he give away a free reading for each donation of $20 or more to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a ministry of Oklava Native American Church or the White Roots of Peace. So please support Prophecy Keepers Radio by making your free will offering at nativeamericanchurch.us. And you'll receive this gift reading. If you choose to make a recurring donation, once you've received your own reading, you can give readings away as free gifts. So why not head over to nativeamericanchurch.us and make an offering right now. Hope to be talking with you soon. Bye now.
I think those sort of things that we may have all done them at will, that all of those so-called secrets or miracles were a normal part of our lives at one time on this planet. I think we are really very, very old. They're constantly pushing back the how old they think humans have been here, how old the Earth able to create another great society with a powerful technology that, again, was not in balance with the energy of Mother Earth. She washed herself clean, and this time it was with a great deal of water. The Hopi say that those that survived, for them, were underground, and that it was then Masao, the great messenger, who reached down with a great ladder and brought the people back out onto the surface of the earth, and took the great truth, the truth that that contains all things, great and small, microcosm and macrocosm, the great truth, and divided it into many parts, gave these parts to the people and sent them in the four directions, each bearing a portion of the great truth. And during this time, they were told that they were to look for signs in the sky of when to stop and build and when to move on. And they were to tell this story at every solstice, winter solstice, that it would be remembered that people needed to know that they had only a portion of the truth, that there were others who traveled with their portion of the sacred truth in the other direction. But this migration took a very long time, and in time there were those who forgot the old stories, who began to think that they had the only truth or the most important truth. And then when they thought of that, then the sacred hoop of the nations was broken, and they began to make a religion from their piece of truth. They built walls around it, and doors that shut out the truth of others. Once the great hoop of the nations was broken, then they began to fill that vacuum, that space, with the technology. And in time, like the other three worlds, that technology went out of balance and began to affect the balance of Mother Earth. And that's where we are now. And the Hopi warned us that David Menunke said that if unchecked, that we would take it to its inevitable course, and we would create a gourd of ashes that would fall from the sky and destroying all life as we knew it, boil the oceans. And then they also said that there would come at this time another technology, and that would be the technology of communication. That if one, as I've seen the petroglyphs there on the rock between the cliff between Arabi and Dagotsmuni, it shows you're out in space and how they knew this, and that there's this Earth in a perfect sphere, and around the Earth, they said, would be a shimmering spider webs in which the people of the four directions could communicate with one another. And that if they did this in a sacred manner, that and they spoke their truth in a sacred manner, and they listened to each other in a sacred manner, then this would mend those fragments of truth, and the truth would be known. And in doing that, the sacred hoop of the nations would be mended. And we would survive into the fifth world. And
that's amazing, because each employee during his orientation at Cherokee Nation headquarters is told that the elders in the 1950s said that someday the world would be surrounded by a spider web.
Yeah.
And
world wide web.
That's right. The Sioux people, Ed McGaw, when we interviewed him a few weeks ago, he said that that this would be the time of communication, and then if it was used for good, it could be used to bring people together.
Exactly.
It's absolutely amazing, the parallels that one can discover when you start to look at all these prophecies. And that's why I do it, because it's just so fascinating.
Well, when I was very young, I was in my, about my mid-20s when I spent that time in RIT and Hotzilla and do RIT. And at that time, because I had not been raised in this tradition, I didn't know what to do with this knowledge. And it seemed like, in a way, I was finally being spoken truth to. But in my, say, 25 years of life, I had swallowed so much garbage, so many social lies and untruths and patronizing things, that it was like I was already full with so much junk that every time they gave me a truth, there would be this huge burst of enlightenment. And then this, soon after, followed by this moment, really hard moment of indigestion, where I would have to go in deep and kick out all kinds of cultural untruths. And that's the thing, is that we just need to empty out and open up, because this is the time of communication and time where we should listen to everyone. I had a teacher once who said, "You're all young. Said, be like sponges. Just take it all in. Listen to it all. Ask people their stories. Find out how it is for the people of the earth in different cultures and things. Take it all in. And those truths will connect like dots together. And all the rest will just fall out by its own weight." So, you know, don't stop the flow by being suspicious or judging. Just witness it. Look at it. You know, and right now I call it the time for connecting the dots. We've all been gathering information for a long time. And we're sacred beings. We can do this.
Reminds me of Uncle John's advice to everyone. He said that everyone needs to lose the word struggle from their vocabulary. And he said there's a river flowing very fast, which is oddly like what Edgar Casey said. And he said that not to fight the current, just to get out in the middle and go with it.
Let me give you his words exactly. Uncle John the Iroquois author says, "We must know that there is a river flowing now very fast. It is so swift and so great that there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel as though they're being torn apart." Uncle John says that this river has its destination, that all that we are asked to do is to push off from the shore into the middle of that river, keep our eyes open and our head above water, and I say, celebrate. See who you find in that river with you at this time, and celebrate. And that's what Uncle John then added, because he said, "Oh, you're adding something to my story, are you?" And I said, "Yes, we need to celebrate." He said, "That's good, because this is an important." He says there are many people who have gotten that they're addicted to struggle. And he said, "You'll never get off the wheel that way. And so what we want to do at this time, so we don't burn out, is just kick the word, the whole concept, struggle. Just kick it right out. Get rid of it. Flush it down the toilet. Stick it in the ground and walk away. And that we are to go on with our lives and do what we do, but do it with a sense of celebration. And then we will never burn out, and others will be attracted and want to join us in this celebration of getting done what must be done." And you can add that or connect that to every on the planet right now.
I couldn't help it. I'll notice after reading that two or three times that most of the people in the American Indian movement, when they sign off a letter, it says yours in struggle, and then they sign their name. So
there's no chance then for that them ever to get beyond that mindset. It just goes round and round. You know, we need to celebrate the life it is that we want to create now. You celebrate it as though it were so, and it is. But in struggle, it's exhausting.
It is, and you
like the word smudge. I don't think they really mean that.
Yeah, smudge sounds something that's dirty and black. But I have known you know a lot of people that.
You're getting hard for me to hear.
Well, I know a lot of folks that were involved in the American Indian movement, and a lot of them get burned out because it's just. It's just so hard and so stressful, and you can't see short-term benefits. Progress. It's a long struggle. So I think Uncle John's advice was good advice, just to go with the flow.
But it changes everything, and it gives you some energy to do it. You know, we can only struggle so long. And then, of course, there's the terrible, what do they call it, lateral violence that happens, I understand, with suppressed people, where what is pushing them down seems so huge and out of reach that they begin to be aggressive and violent in spiritual ways to each other. And that's been a terrible problem among the Native American new communities, in that they tear each other down.
They do. Yeah, it's...
Instead of supporting.
There's a lot of young people that get involved in that kind of behavior, and it's so self-destructive. By the way, I always have wondered, by any chance, is Uncle John, John Fadden?
I don't know. Is John Fadden Iroquois?
Yeah, he, John, pretty much single-handedly, I guess he and Jake Swamp, and maybe a few other elders, they literally brought the Six Nations back from, there was just hardly anything going on culturally. They taught an entire generation, retaught them their, along with Mad Bear Anderson and a few others, retaught them how to govern themselves and got them to be proud again of their culture. His son, Ray, runs the Six Nations Museum, I believe it's in New York.
I don't know if this is the same person. I never knew him other than as Uncle John, and the first couple of times were long phone calls, and then I finally did meet him, and I was able to stay in a place up in Santa Barbara, a gathering of people for about 3 days, and he was there. All that I know is that at the time he was living with his family somewhere near the Kern River. Oops, I'm sitting in front of an open window. So I don't know, but those men, they have done some wonderful, wonderful work, and I just am so grateful that they're there.
Well, it's certainly good words of advice. What did the elders tell you would happen once the migration was completed? Did they talk with you about that?
Yes. That if in using this technology of the shimmering spider's web, that if we put the emphasis on that and that communication, and then, you know, it's going to be one or the other. If we don't communicate and communicate truth, then that's it. We have now created weapons so terrible that we may look like the planet Mars in, who knows, 10 that capable, that crazy capability to do that to ourselves. Or if, in fact, we go and put the emphasis on the technology of communication and mend the sacred hoop by honoring each other and listening to each other's truths, then the Hopi say that at that time they will intermarry and that all people will become mixed, that we will truly become one people in honor and respect and in a sacred manner, and that this time we may go from this, the fourth world, into the fifth without that whole terrible destruction, that it's like an evolution. And there will be peace and abundance for all.
So it's up to us, and like they said, the ones that you have been waiting for are you.
Yes, we are the ones that we've been waiting for.
Of course, the flip side of that is, you know, I've met the enemy, and they are us.
Yeah, ouch. Yeah, well, it's all a paradox, isn't it, when you get down to it.
Friends, this is Will Blue Otter, encouraging you to obtain an authorized participant or AP card and become a federally recognized Native religious practitioner. Presently, Aklavan Native American Church is the only Native American church spiritually blessed by the Rosebud Reservation Native American Church and has a certificate of existence in the state of Utah that is authorized to worship on or off tribal grounds and has met the standard of sincerity and vow of poverty standards in the state of Utah and federal courts. This card is designed to assist all people regardless of their racial makeup, political affiliation, social and or financial status, and receiving their constitutional rights. This card is also designed to assist United States judicial officials to honor their solemn oath to protect and exercise the principles of the United States Constitution while carrying out their duty and serving their fellow citizens. To join the movement that is strengthening and exercising the principles of the United States Constitution, please obtain your AP card by visiting NativeAmericanChurch.us today.
Well, yeah, like you, I wasn't raised in the culture, but it's it really is interesting because I was brought up. My parents weren't particularly religious, but they believed in spiritual things, and especially had a respect for prophecy and. I just couldn't help growing up, once I started hearing about the Native prophecies, I couldn't help notice the similarities, but for a while I thought, oh well, you know, you have no way of knowing, those may just be prophecies that Native people had borrowed from Christian people, and that's one of the first assumptions, which is a mistaken assumption that people could make. And then I looked a little bit deeper, like I always do, and realized that the breadth and width and length of these prophecies is so great and so much more voluminous than anything. Even the Tibetans, when they came and met the Hopi, they commented that they were astounded at the prophetic tradition. They said, oh, well, we have lots of prophecies too, but they're written down and stored in the basement, and they said, we'll have to go home and brush them off. But
1973, that was. They've been here a couple of times since then with the Hopi, and that was the big time that it happened, and they met each other. The Hopi were expecting them. They had prophecies that even named the particular color of the sect that would come. And then they went down into the kivas together and stayed there for, from what I understand, several days, and just were in wonder and joy and very serious and very happy in so many places where they had the same stories County for 5 years called Songs for the Earth, Mending the Sacred Hoop. And while I was there, I met two musicians, Daniel Becker Gallegos and Pony Vigil, two Native American musicians. And so they wanted to put some music behind the sacred stories that I had been told, the creation, migration, and prophecy stories. So we filled a tape before CD with about 54 minutes of the Chumash, some of Uncle John's There is a River, and the Hopi stories, and stories about one of the Cherokee elders, Nahani Wahoo. And somehow a copy of that tape made it to New Zealand, and I got a letter saying, here is your ticket to Aotearoa. We expect you at this time. We have missing pieces. Oh, you have missing pieces of our stories, and we have some for you.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh,
but
yeah.
By any chance, did you meet Maki Ruka? Yeah.
I don't think so.
Maki he's walked west now, but another one of my guests traveled with him quite a bit, and Maki did quite a bit of teaching. And just wonder if it was pronounced Maki, actually, Maki Ruka.
Yeah.
But he's one of their elders, and. Well, isn't that interesting? So you got a invitation to go down there. Isn't that amazing how everything's connected?
Yeah, it certainly isn't, especially now. And one of the things that I was warned, who told me, which of the elders, I think it was Thomas Manyakya, said to me that in the time of the purification, there would be a great polarization. And there was no middle ground. There were the people that were for life, living, and the Maoris would have called them the Tuiwi. And then there would be those who operated from darkness and only created death. Well, and the Maori called those people the Pākehā. And here you are. I mean, look at it. You've got our whole government is a death cult, you know, we've been lied to just severely. It's 1984 and then some. And it's a death cult. That's what they're manufacturing. That's what they're making. And that's what they're not blowing up. They're polluting. And I love my seafood. And I can't just, I'm having to live like everyone so defensively because they're literally poisoning the earth. They have no right for that. To do that, and I have grandchildren now, and I think about that.
Yeah,
so here's our polarization time for sure. Have you read the story about the Blanket of Hope you mentioned a few minutes ago about the Diné prophecies?
Yeah, I've been.
This is one of them, and that blanket actually exists, you know.
Yes, there's a picture of it. That I borrowed off of your website, and people can see it at prophecykeepers.com.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And why don't you go ahead and tell us about it?
Well, the website, do you know, is it .org or .com? I forget.
Chakosh.org.
Oh. Well, it has actually its own website. It's www.theblanketofhope.org/.com.
That's right. That's right. You do. It does. It does have its own website.
Yeah.
Let me look it up here. And go ahead. While I'm doing that, go ahead and tell us about.
Well, that blanket was woven by Asonia Begay, and it was brought to me by three Navajo women elders, and that would have been around 1986, I think, maybe early 87, during the protest against making the Negro Sarah, what was he, about that time, and it's a beautiful, magnificent blanket. It's exactly 6 feet long by, maybe 2 feet.
Looks like it's 6 by just a little under 3 feet. It is theblanketofhope.org.
Oh, it is. www.theblanketofhope.org. Well, it's a very, very important story, and it shows the three court meetings. And I'll just share with you how this story was told to me. This blanket is a blanket of prophecy. And it shows that the main figures are three court maidens, and they are bearing arrows, ascending and descending. These are arrows of truth. And the story of the blanket goes that one day we will find this world in famine and despair, and it is because truth has not been spoken. And if we are to survive, it will be because the truth, the feminine truth that is in every woman and in every man, must step forward. And that if those arrows find their mark, then, and the arrows ascending, descending, to me that means there are truths that will now ascend, and some truths that we have been fooled into thinking were false truths must descend. And he said that if the feminine truth steps forward, and there are truths that descend and other truths that ascend, and if they find their mark, then it shows corn growing on either side of the corn maidens. And that means that the reason why we're in all the trouble that we are, if you get all the way down, this is sort of like the string theory of what's happened to Mother Earth, and that is that we are out of balance. The Creator has made things in symmetry, in balance, so that they work, so they can be in harmony. And there isn't just men. There are men and women. And that there is a male truth and a feminine truth that need to work together. But the feminine truth that men are ashamed of in themselves or afraid to show, and the feminine truth that is in women, which has been suppressed, is like a great bird that was created with two wings to fly. One wing is very strong and the other one is bound. As long as it is like that, this bird is going to go round in circles, knock a lot of things over, create a big mess, and never get off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That everything, the truth of everything is the truth of everything. That we must release that other wing so it can balance, and then that bird can take flight. We are in this terrible time of aggression, destruction, one-upmanship, king of the mountain, who's got more, and, you know, this is a very masculine energy, and it is not tempered by the feminine, and it is the feminine who really does mature earlier, is the social one, loves communication. This needs to balance that masculine. If we were in balance, we wouldn't be spending trillions of dollars on war machines and only few millions on education and health.
Well,
we need to take care of our people. How can they call themselves, what is it, the first law of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not kill. There's no excuse. It is no more an evolved solution than the caveman's use.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the worst, the stupidest. So easy to desecrate and destroy told. So I told that story about, oh, by the way, it doesn't promise that the feminine truth will step forward. It says if the feminine truth steps forward and the arrows find their mark, we have to make that choice. It's up to us who are the ones we've been waiting for. So I finished telling the story, and there was a Kauia, elder grandmother, Maori, sitting in the front. She was all excited. She was rolling back and forth on her haunches, and she kept pointing at the blanket. She said, finally, she just couldn't keep herself still anymore, and she said, the border, you didn't tell them about the border. Well, I had never thought about the border. It's a beautiful border of spirals and steps, sort of.
Looks kind of like waves.
Huh?
Looks kind of like waves.
Yeah. Well, she said, look at our flax wall, leaf wall designs that we have here. And, of course, they were the same thing that you see in the Mayan and Aztec carvings on the temples. And she said, tell them about the border. And I said, well, it's a very nice border, but I don't know what it means. And she said, oh, well, we do. And she hops right up and she explained the border to me, which is also in the website about it. It shows it. And she said, you see, these spirals are the truth of nature. If you want to understand life, you must take off your shoes, she said, and feel the earth, smell the earth, get grounded that way, and know that the laws that govern all of our lives come from our connection to nature. And then she said, and do you see the stairways that are supported by the spiral of the laws of nature? And I said, yes. She said, well, we call that the staircase to heaven. And I started to panic, and I stopped her right there, not wanting to be disrespectful. But I said, does this come from the missionary teachings? And she said, no, she said. This is our life, and every one of these steps is an obstacle. And what you do is every time you meet another step, instead of calling it an obstacle, like the word struggle, you just say thank you, and you take that step. And for a while, you rest on that step, and you learn that lesson. And pretty soon, there's another step. Just say thank you, and take that step. And she said, if you keep doing that, and that's what we're here for, then eventually you come to this place of peace. And acknowledge that you've embodied.
Reminds me of Sun Tzu wrote The Art of War, and I think he mentioned that the word crisis really means opportunity.
Yes, isn't that wonderful? You know, in a sweat lodge, the first time I ever went into a sweat lodge was in 1978 in the occupation of Point Conception, where I received my name in Santa Barbara. And I wore this kind of rayon muumuu dress inside. I didn't have a bathing suit. I don't like that anyway. But so I went in there, and I started to get so hot, and then I just became terrified. It was so dark, so close, so sweaty, and the heat was so intense that it actually melted the back yoke on my dress.
Oh my word!
So it really did get that hot, and I was very shamed, but I had to go out after the third round. Then Archie Fire Lake Deer, who was there, said, you must go back in again, and this time you sit with me. And so I sat next to him, and what he told me was this. He said, the heat from the stone people is like the challenges of life. It's your fears, your ego, your attachment and connection to things that are keeping you down and confused. And so he said, what you do is don't lie down on the ground. Don't cover. But instead, when it comes, lean forward into the heat and with your hands bring it to you. Because like life, when the difficulties come and the fear comes, it's going to happen anyway. So instead of being the victim and just being hit by it, reach into it with your being and bring it to you and say thank you.
Prophecy Keeper, Prophecy Keeper.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide. And then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keeper's does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
And then it changes, like our nemesis becomes our ally. He said you will never be in a sweat lodge or in a situation in your life where the heat is too much for you. He said, a grandmother then added a part to it. She said, it is not the events in our life which cause us the pain. It is our resistance. And so when you remove the resistance and you welcome it to you, it's going to come anyway. You might as well welcome it to you and say thank you. And there is this infinite. You can feel it. Sweat lodge. Suddenly, it isn't too hot. It's a part of you. There's no resistance. It moves through you. It's a great, this is why I call it teachings for spiritual warriors in a hurry. Because these wonderful spiritual truths, they don't take years and years in a mystery school. They don't take sitting on a pillow forever and whatever you're supposed to do by that route. The truth is so much there that in a moment you can test it and know that it works. And it used to be a part of our culture. We all knew this, but we forgot.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that really astounded me when I started walking down this path was when I discovered that the elders said that at this time it would be a time when all of the old beliefs, the lost beliefs, the medicine societies that had died, would all begin to come back, that all the truths would be taught through spirit. And then, of course, the counterpart to that from the Eastern Hemisphere in the Bible, it says that this is the time of the restitution of all things spoken of by all the mouths of all the holy prophets. And that kind of thing can really get your attention. And that's the time that we live in. And, you know, my wife and I were just talking about this the other night. I'll be 50 in December. She's your age. She's 61. And I was saying to her, Betty, I said, do you realize that the world that we live in now is completely different? It's almost like a different planet from the world that you grew up in the 50s and I grew up in the 60s. And she says, oh, yes. She says, it's just completely different place. And, it was prophesied. Absolutely amazing, the things that are happening.
Yes, it is. But, you know, we have tools. I used to teach different courses or gatherings, and in this Tools for Spiritual Warriors, the first series was Sacred Breath, and there's so much
Now, did you say sacred breath?
Breath, and in breathing.
Well, one of the things that every once in a while spirit whispers things to me, and now this would be going back to about 10 years ago. It was about the time that my first wife passed away. Just before she passed away, there were four things that were told me in one night, and one of the things was, remember the sacred breath. So I, the implications of that are, well, it's something I already know, and I have to figure out what it is, and then the sacred breath, is it breath? Is it the master of life? Who's the sacred breath? Breath is everything, and it's nothing too. And it's just one of those things that's had me thinking for a long time. It's just like once or twice a year, Creator will tell me something, and he gave me a prophecy in August of 2000. He said the three have been trying to come for the past 400 years, but they have been unable to come because the people have not been ready.
We're not breathing right.
Mm-hmm. And he said they are coming in 2004, so get ready.
Did you say the three?
The three.
Oh.
And I got to thinking, that's really interesting. Are we talking about Masao and his two helpers? Or are we talking about the three that appeared to Handsome Lake? And, of course, three corn maidens. The three can be seen several times in the Bible. The Book of Mormon. There were the three that appeared to Abraham. So it's a very mystical thing when you start talking about the three. And what could happen this year. Of course, Edgar Cayce, there's a very little known prophecy that Edgar Cayce left concerning 2004, which was just announced not too long ago. He said that in 2004 there would be a new race that would be established. And when you said that we would all intermarry, the first thing I thought when I heard that Edgar Cayce prophecy was, well, that has to be the Rainbow Tribe, the real fulfillment of it, not what we see nowadays, but something that's really true and lasting.
Can I offer you the Shemesh creation about the people of the heart?
Please do.
Okay. This was told to me by Grandfather Victor Lopez and also one of our Chumash people, Cody Luna.
End of part one. Please refer to program notes for the scheduled date and time of part two. Thank you for supporting Prophecy Keepers Radio with your tax-deductible offerings to the Oklava Native American Church of the White Roots of Peace.
Let the truth be known to all mankind again.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius.
Prophecy keeper, oh yeah. Let the truth be known.